So the story of the Vermont AFL-CIO over the last 5 years or so is starts off from the same place that, frankly, most state labor councils are in today. It's one of inaction. It's one of decreasing membership. It's one of folks not even knowing, and I'm not exaggerating here, workers, what the AFL-CIO even is. In 2017, we had a convention that was representing 10,000 workers, the highest decision-making body in labor in Vermont, that had 20-something delegates there representing 10,000 workers. That, to me, is as close to dead as you can be without being lowered into the ground and having dirt thrown on top of you. So at that time, myself and leaders from a number of different unions, I come out of AFSCME, so AFSCME, and the building trades, and college professors that were with AFT, unions all across the state, a number of us got together and said, enough is enough. Something radical has to change. Something major has to change, or we are not going to exist anymore. So what we did is we formed something called the United Slate, which is the most progressive state labor council slate or caucus in the United States of America. We traveled around to union shops to talk with the rank and file all across Vermont to ask what their concerns were. What are their priorities? What do they want to see changed? And from that process, we developed a 10-point program called a 10-point program for union power, also known as the Little Green Book. And we made that our campaign platform. We built a huge, unprecedented coalition of unions, the great majority of unions across Vermont, to run for all leadership positions. I ran for president. We were contested by some very large AFT locals and the firefighters, the steel workers, a number of unions. It wasn't unanimous, were against us. Now, if you know anything about labor, having a contested election in and of itself is highly unusual. There is this notion that people get elected to positions and keep them for life. We call them the old guard. And the Vermont AFL-CIO of the old guard never communicated with rank and file. They might call up a local president if there's somebody of note to vaguely get an idea, or a business agent, of where they should stand on one bill or another. But most of their activity was spent lobbying in the State House, putting money and resources into lobbying to try to pass bills that never moved. Never went anywhere. And then when the elections came, we would endorse anywhere between 50 and 100 Democrats, far as I could tell, just because they were Democrats. And guess what? They would almost all win. And then we would get nothing again in the State House. They would do this year in and year out and see no results. And the number of union members attending conventions, attending union actions, went down, 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 and people couldn't figure out why. Nationally, of course, our union density in the U.S. hits a high point in the 1950s with 35% membership. Today, our membership is about at 10%. 10% nationally. So what does the national AFL-CIO and the Vermont AFL-CIO, before United took over, before we came into power, have in common? Putting all of our eggs in the baskets of hitching our wagon to the Democratic Party, and put in a lion's share of our resources into lobbying that goes nowhere and gets us nothing. And if anybody questions that, let's remember under Obama, Democrats in all three branches of government promised the Employee Free Choice Act, card check, never happened. Under Biden, promised us number one priority is going to be the PRO Act. That went nowhere. And people wonder why membership goes down. People wonder why union participation of the rank and file goes down. And when we campaign, the first question people tended to ask me when I'd go into a shop is I'd say, listen, my name is Dave Van Duz. I'm running with a United Slate. We want to change the way the AFL-CIO operates. We want to become a progressive union. We want to democratize the labor movement. They would kind of stop me and say, well, first tell me what the AFL-CIO is. That was where we started. So we won that election, building this huge coalition. It was close, and we pulled it out. It was close for president. In the other races, we won overwhelming victories on the majority, all except for one seat on the executive board. And the very first thing we did, the very first, is we stopped funding the outside lobbyists, and we took that money and put it into an organizing department. We brought on-call organizers, right, who could work for a day or a week or a month, whatever it takes. And when affiliates would reach out to us and say, we need help, we wouldn't just say, sure, what document do you want us to sign? You know, because that's the old way of doing it, signing something, a letter. We'd say, do you want an organizer? And if so, for how long? And then we would democratically place that organizer under the authority of that local. So we weren't over their shoulders dictating the strategy and the tactics on the floor. It would keep it a little more local that way. That tangibly has helped us organize new shops. The other thing we did is we stopped backing the Democrats just because they're Democrats. We came up with a new policy. Our members voted on it, not just the executive board, not just the decision myself. We had our members spend a whole day at a political summit saying, this doesn't work. What are we going to do differently? We facilitated them hearing from all sorts of political positions. We brought in the Democratic Party even. We brought in a couple folks from the Workers Caucus, the Legislative Caucus Democrats that tend to say or sometimes support us. We brought in the Progressive Party. In Vermont, we have a Social Democratic Party called the Progressive Party. Bernie Sanders was the founder of that has real seats and has a lieutenant governorship and is a real force in Vermont, right? We brought them in. We brought the Democratic Social Americas in. We brought Migrant Justice, a group of farm workers, largely without documentation, who are essentially organizing a union, to hear their views on these issues. We brought in a cross-section of all sorts of political views, and at the end, we spent an hour and a half debating rank-and-file members how to do politics differently. And what we came up out of that is we're going to inform the politicians. We're going to inform all three major political parties what our priorities are for the next biennium, the next session of legislature. And if any party, a critical mass of that party, does not get behind whatever it is, then we're going to hold the whole party accountable, all of it. And there will be a moratorium on endorsing candidates from that party, not that individual, that party, until they make that right. So guess what? Can you guess? Within the first year, we said, we want livable wages, right? Legislation. We want card check union recognition for the public sector. And we want this reclassification enforcement system for the building trades that would be more fair and more robust. They met us part way on the livable wages. They did the right thing for our building trades. And they didn't pass card check. Republicans and Democrats. Progressive Party was with us all the way. But they were like 10 people in the state house as opposed to 150. So a moratorium went in place for the Republican and Democratic parties. Now you might say, because we're at an anarchist book fair, well, why not just walk away from electoral politics? Why not just say a pox on all their, right, on both their houses? I would expect that question in this venue. But here's the thing. We're not doing the political work we do because I or five other people or 10 other people have some ideas and some good principles. We need to be a reflection of where our members are at. And frankly, our members are not at the place where we're not going to engage in any way, shape, or form in electoral politics. But they knew something was broken because they could see when we endorsed the Democrats that we're not getting anything for it. So that's why we set up this system that would trigger a moratorium. So workers themselves can see how we, in a transparent, straightforward way, put their priorities forward that they voted on, saying that these are the three most important things. And then we let the political parties fail, or rather they let themselves fail. And then the moratorium went in. And so folks that weren't ready to walk away from mainstream political elections instead saw that there was a cause and effect. And I'll tell you what, since we've adopted this approach, we've gotten more through the State House than we ever have before. And right now, this week, we're about to pass the Vermont PRO Act out of the House, which makes it a much more robust system of organizing, changing power balances in the state of Vermont. So what do? We took our money out of lobbying. We put it into developing an organizing department. We stopped blindly supporting the Democratic Party, and then we start seeing legislation pass as a result. And we started being unafraid with making alliances and developing relationships within the communities, working with groups like Black Perspective, working with groups like Migrant Justice, working with climate groups such as 350 Vermont on trying to get pressure and support for Green New Deal, progressively funded Green New Deal. We started doing these things and also being proactive on larger social issues, because that's how we're going to amplify our power, right? That's how we're going to be strong. It's not going to be just from the labor movement. It's not going to be just from the communities. It's going to be all of these things together. And guess what? All of this stuff made the national AFL-CIO incredibly unhappy and uncomfortable. You think that wouldn't be the case, because when we started 2018, we had 10,000 members. And now today, however many years later it is, there are 20,000 Vermont AFL-CIO members in Vermont. So we have measurable results with new union shops, and we're doing the right things, but the old guard hates it. And what do they hate most? When we took a strong stance in support of folks after the murder of George Floyd, and we called for a moratorium on organizing new police unions, and we became the first major labor organization in the United States of America to explicitly state our support for black self-determination in the United States. Richard Trumka, who is now deceased, threatened to take us under trusteeship undemocratically as a result, and we said, to hell with you. We're doing it anyway. This is a democratic process. We're a democratic organization. You're not going to dictate terms from Washington, D.C. And when there was a concern about a coup in the United States of America going to November 2020, we called for a convention and had a robust discussion. And at the end of that discussion, what would we be willing to do to defend democracy should this republic come under existential crisis? And our members overwhelmingly voted, over 80%, to empower the elected executive board to call for a general strike in Vermont if there was not a transfer of power in January 2021 after Trump lost that election. And we took real concrete steps to organize and to support that general strike. We worked very closely with key figures in Burlington, in Montpelier, our state capital, Burlington being our biggest city, and in Bennington, which was the birthplace of anyone who knows a little Vermont history. We took steps to be prepared for that general strike. And again, that came out of the membership, not the leadership, which is important to state. Now, I'm happy that there was a transfer of power and that there was not a fascist coup that was successful in this country. But Richard Trumka, again, came very close. He said, you know, all but, I'm going to set the process in motion to remove you all from office and take you over from Washington, D.C. He expected us to play the game from the inside like the old guard would, make appeals, talk to some other international president. We took our fight public. We fought for the right thing in public, in full view, doing interviews with Pacifica, doing interviews with anybody who wanted to talk with us, and organizing supporters from all around the globe, because the fact was we were ready to step up and do what needed to be done in a time of crisis. And by the way, you know what the national AFL-CIO tried to convince us to do when there was a coup threat going? I swear to God, the Eastern Regional Director, a real snake in the grass named David Driscoll Knight, he suggested, instead of having a general strike authorization vote and preparing for that, that we set up tables at a couple of post offices to explain to Vermonters what democracy is. That was their goal. That was their strategy. Think about that. So the Vermont AFL-CIO has been doing the right thing since 2019. It's been hard. But when we've done the right thing, we have seen well over 100 delegates consistently take part in our conventions, their decision-making processes, where before there wasn't even two dozen. We have put people on picket lines and won real fights on the job. We continue to engage publicly, arguing that we need a more empowered town meeting system so we could actually have a direct democracy in Vermont as a whole, not just on the municipal level. And in fact, we have, through our allies, we're hopeful in the next biennium to have that constitutional amendment introduced in the Vermont Senate, which our process calls for needing to be introduced in the Senate first. But these things weren't easy. They were hard. Every step of the way, we faced challenges, we faced threats, and we faced moments where we could have imploded at any time. Building consensus among our key constituents, among our partners in United, our caucus, is not always an easy thing. But without that unity, reaction is going to win. We do not pretend to have all the answers. We know, in fact, that we do not. But we also know that we've been growing at a faster pace than any other state in the nation when it comes to unionization. And we know that we are building a much stronger left in Vermont than we're seeing in nearly any other state in the nation. So we're doing the right things, and we've won four elections in a row. Every time we've been up against opposition, we have won. And those elections, some of them have been hard, but we've come through because the workers, the rank and file, has been with us. So that's a bit of the overview. I'd like to have a little bit of a conversation because I know some of you all are probably engaged with unions. And frankly, trying to change unions from within is hard. And, you know, maybe some of the things we did in Vermont are not going to be comparable to what you're facing where you are, but maybe they will. But for those folks that do have an interest in hearing more about this story and diving down into it a little bit, PM Press, I'm happy to say, printed this, is out now in Surgent Labor, the Vermont AFL-CIO 2017-2023. It's available inside the warehouse. You know, feel free to peruse. And I always like to say, if you don't like the book, whatever they give me that royalty, I don't know if it's a dollar or something like that, I'll give you back your dollar if you don't like it. I give you a promise on that. I can't speak for PM, though. They probably want to keep their money, if they're wise. Yeah, no, what you see going on with the United Auto Workers right now is incredible. Now, folks will recall the stand-up strike that resulted in historic contracts with the big three automakers and then the victory at Volkswagen in Chattanooga the other day. Sean Fain, the new president, comes out of a radical caucus, UAWD, their pro-democracy caucus within the UAW. Now, here's the interesting thing. Because of corruption within the former administration, the federal government essentially forced them the caucus also was fighting for this, to have direct elections, one member, one vote, where previously those elections were done through a delegate system, which is very undemocratic and is very easy to manipulate if you're the old guard. With one member, one vote, the leftist caucus won a majority of the leadership positions within the UAW, including Sean Fain for president. So instead of making a cozy deal with the automakers, the capitalists, they went to war. And they won, because when we fight, we win. But their fight is not over just with those contracts and not just with the win at Volkswagen. I believe it's sometime in the next 2 weeks, the Mercedes plant in Alabama is also going to vote. And I've been told that they have 2/3 majority support in that plant there. These are the first auto plants in the South being unionized. I mean, this is massive. But now the question becomes, when our workers do good, do those plants now go overseas because of free trade agreements largely crafted by the Democrats? So Sean Fain and the caucus is sending resources and know-how and organizers to Mexico to work with the independent trade unions in Mexico in the auto industry to help build their power. So everywhere the capitalists turn, there is sources of resistance. This is very smart. In fact, Sean Fain, I had the pleasure of seeing him speak at Labor Notes in Chicago a week or two ago. And right before him, he brought with him one of the leaders from one of the auto plants they're helping to organize down south of the border. And let's not forget that the new UAW is also taking an internationalist position. They were one of the early unions to come out saying we need justice in Palestine, right? That's huge. And they are pushing within the national AFL-CIO for more democracy and a more progressive approach to unionism. Now, right now on the national scale, there's only a handful of truly progressive, far-thinking union leaders in positions of big authority. He is one. Sarah Nelson from the Flight Attendants Association is another who's incredible. Mark Dimenstein from APWU, the postal workers, who are also very early in coming out demanding justice for Palestine, represent a core with Sean O'Brien on the outside because they're not the AFL-CIO. But they represent a core of leftist change within organized labor that we have not seen in decades. So I'm very hopeful about the future of labor, but it's not going to just be through these big folks at the top where the change is going to happen. This has to be at every level, be it a local central labor council, a state labor council like we've been doing in Vermont. And then we have to find a way to stitch it all together to build a national caucus within the AFL-CIO of progressive unions so we could fight against the old guard and put a final nail in the coffin of that failed old way of doing things. But as far as the international aspect goes, that's key. Because the fight against capitalism, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, almost literally in this case, at Anarchist Book Fair, but the fight against capital is international. The capitalists are international, and so the working class has to be international as well. In our caucus, within the Vermont AFL-CIO, once we took power, we were outspoken on a number of international issues. We condemned, long before what's going on, right, the horrible ethnic cleansing that's going on in Palestine today, we publicly condemned the continuing occupation of Palestine, called for justice for Palestinian people. We also sent one of our top officers to Cuba for May Day a couple years ago. It was the highest ranking, she was our executive vice president, Katie Harris, who's now president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, highest ranking union officer in Havana for the U.S. officer for the May Day demonstrations in Havana. But also, something that's very close to my heart is Rojava. Through a request of the, it was passed on by the Emergency Committee for Rojava, that the Kurdish unions in Rojava were looking to make connections and relationships with American trade unions. So we had two meetings with the top leadership of the Kurdish unions in Rojava. One was a private meeting where our leadership and theirs heard from each other to hear what the struggles are we're both facing in our corners of the world and how we could perhaps support each other. The second meeting, we had a public meeting where we invited union members, whoever wanted to, you know, it was a remote meeting, to jump in to hear about their struggles right now facing down Turkish bombs and aerial attacks and attacks on civilian infrastructure, which, by the way, is provided by U.S. guns, essentially, not different than what's going on, although not as big of a scale, what's going on in Palestine, a NATO member, Turkey. And that act had meaning to a member, many of our leaders in the U.S. side, in the Vermont side, to actually hear firsthand about the horrible things that are going on, and also to hear about the beautiful things going on of building, trying to build a direct democracy in that corner of the Middle East that is secular and that is, frankly, a feminist in character. So that was very exciting, but that's a start. That's relationship building. The challenges that local labor bodies will always face if they're in the AFL-CIO, we're doing international solidarity, is the national AFL-CIO claims jurisdiction over any issues that are national or international in scale. And then when the San Francisco Central Labor Council, for example, wanted to take up a position statement on Palestine, the national AFL-CIO sent paid staff there to say, if you do this, you're going to be in big trouble. We're going to shut you down. We might take you over. And, you know, they have to make their own decisions. Everyone's got to make their own calculations. But San Francisco CLC, a couple years ago, they chickened out. The pressure got too much to them, and they didn't take a position. We took risk with the Vermont AFL-CIO. If you read the book, they're not always easy decisions to make, and there were some risks we didn't take. We got to put these things on a scale and decide, is this the one that we go to the mat on? Is this the one that we're willing to die on? And frankly, when it came to the general strike and preparing for that, our calculation was this. Sure, they might take us all out of office. They might kick us out. They might run a dictatorship here in Vermont. But if we're looking at the end of what vestiges of democracy we have in this country ending, what are we saving for? Do I need a title next to my name when we're living under a fascist dictatorship? Is that going to somehow make me feel better about it? So like that was one that we felt, come hell or high water, we're going to do the right thing, even if it's the hard thing. But that doesn't mean every single thing should be the hard thing. If we're going to build and win, we have to get stronger. We can't just say, whatever it is, this is right, and f*** you, because we know what is right. The question is, are we building power? And how are we building power? Because we haven't won yet. So every calculation, every risk we make as a labor movement in this context needs to be very intentional and needs to have an eye on building power and getting to the point where we feel we could change the balance of power in the United States to become a more economically equitable society, one based on more democracy. And are we going towards that or not? Every risk isn't the risk to take. Well, in our case, it was a different situation. So in a small way, it was like we had a political revolution in our labor council. In 2019, we seized power. That's what we did. Democratically, we seized power. So there was no longer, for a period of years, an effective eternal opposition. There was an opposition, but we already won. And one of the things I think you can't be afraid to do is wield power once you achieved it. You can't always be looking to stretch your arm out for a handshake to your enemies. Sometimes it is the right thing to do to win and then do the right thing, right, because you've won. There's ramifications for winning and losing. The challenge that we have always had is the national AFL-CIO, because the national AFL-CIO, they operate under Byzantine bylaws that give dictatorial power to the folks at the top. Now, for those of you engaged in international and are less into the AFL-CIO politics, but maybe the IBW, UUP, or whatever it may be, you're going to have your mini Byzantiums within those internationals, right? It's going to be the same dynamic, but it's going to win the international. So IBW might say, hey, whatever you want to talk about, that's not your business. That's for the international to decide. Or the local or whatever it is, right? You're going to face layers to these challenges. So you're going to have to figure out how to address those in the most appropriate ways. What we did is on the state level, we became the thing that used to be the obstacle. And then we could go directly to members and engage in discussions. And those obstacles weren't there. But the national AFL-CIO, 12.5 million members. Now, let me ask you a question. If I was to tell you there was a country, and there's plenty of them, smaller than this even, of 12.5 million people. And if I say, I want you to tell me, I'm going to tell you how they pick their leader, and I want you to tell me if it's a democracy or not. Okay, so let's pretend in this fictitious country, there's like a Politburo, a political group of 500 people that choose who all the leaders is. Would you call that a democracy? Come on. No? No, I wouldn't either. That's exactly how the national AFL-CIO picks its leadership. 500 delegates, give or take, once every X amount of years, get together, and they anoint. You're allowed to run, but think about it. That's not much of a democratic process or campaign. It's all decided long before it happens. So that's how it used to be in Vermont in many regards, and that's what we have overturned. Now the question is, can Vermont, can the flight attendants, can the UAW, can the postal workers, these places that are becoming more and more progressive, can we come together to create a national caucus like we did, like a national united caucus, to challenge the very premise of how the AFL-CIO exists today? So our biggest challenge in the labor movement, I would say, at least on a large scale, is the bureaucratic structures and the inherently undemocratic processes by which an unpopular old guard perpetuates itself in power. I'd say the number one thing in general is long before you start having conversations about transforming the local or transforming the Central Labor Council, credibility. You need to have credibility. You need to be good at your job. You need to be, in your case, a good electrician. But you also, being a good steward, right? Oftentimes with union groups, people will invite you, if you're interested, to become a steward, right? To get involved with that. And to being knowledgeable about your contract and being strong on the bread and butter issues. If you're not strong on the bread and butter issues, all the rest is just noise. Like, one of the things that we did as part of United is, like, we didn't just do this, right? A number of us have been involved with the labor movement for many years and have been part of those contract fights, have been part of those fights to the employer and all of this. And we've been part of winning fights. And it's with that credibility, then people are willing to, like, with my AFSCME locals, right? We have 9 locals in Vermont. I've been at war against employers with them all over the state, you know, and I've been with them when things are going well. I've been with them when things are going bad, for the victories, the defeats, all of it. I've drank whiskey with those folks and everything in between. And so when I'm able to go to them and say, listen, it's time we democratize. We need to not only win, but then we need to double the amount of delegates we all get at our conventions, which we did. We need to create a higher floor before you could go to a weighted vote system on issues, right? We want to encourage participatory democracy in our decision-making bodies. If I was to do that day one, and I'm not saying you're day one by any stretch, I'm just saying in general, if you do that day one, you're just a know-it-all. Right, but you know your job, your trade, your skills, and you get respected as a coworker, and you get respected knowing the contract and being willing to engage on the little. It might seem little, but you know Joe Blow is being denied that extra bereavement day, and you go and fight for that and get that extra bereavement day. Then when you go to Joe 6 months later and say we need to do something radically different, Joe's going to listen. So building credibility has to be a key component of changing the labor market. But it's a long road. Like the transformation of a local, transformation of a union could be tough. I was just listening to the elected director of Region 9 UAW in Chicago the other day. And he won the upset victory in his race. He was part of the reform slate. And one of the things he was saying, and like mind you, a year ago, he was building boat engines on the assembly line. Like this is what he did. He was not a career, you know, union official. And he beat the career union official. And he was saying that when they were running to take over their own union, retake it, people said, you can't be doing that. You got to wait in line. People have been waiting years for this. You know, get in line, kid. And he said, well, you know, them. Because they were losing, and it's time we have to do something different. So once you have that credibility, I think it is important at times to not be afraid to fight. And don't be quiet. Because if you're quiet, it's just going to empower the same inertia, the same bullshit that's been going on for 40 years. And that's not going to be comfortable either at times. Well, look, this isn't a utopian story. And, you know, there's not always fairy tale endings. So when we overcame the firefighters and the steelworkers and a majority of the AFT locals in our election, firefighters and a number of AFT locals, not all, took their ball and went home. They just walked away. They took their dues out. Dues for a lot of unions are somewhat voluntary when it comes to going, sending it to the state organization. They took their ball and went home. So what did we do? We made every good faith attempt we could to rebuild a version of solidarity. We assigned different people from within our caucus who had personal relationships with people in different locals to go and do outreach to those locals to try to get them involved and engaged and say, look, we ran against you. We beat you. That's fine. But where do we have common ground and where can we work on these commonalities? In some groups that worked, they came back, and in some they didn't. And it's an ongoing process, you know, and you got to be a little smart about things. Like when we ran our last campaign, I already did 2 terms as president. I didn't run for re-election, which reminds me, I think being able to pass the torch, I think, is an important thing, too, if we're going to build a movement and not build movements based around personalities. But that's kind of a side issue. So we were smart in our last election. We ran another AFSCME woman, Katie Maurice Harris, for president, who now serves as the youngest at 31 State Labor Council president in the United States of America. She's also a member of DSA. And for vice president, we ran somebody, an up-and-coming, strong, natural leader, rank-and-file leader from the AFT, from the same unions that we had conflict with. Now, in the long run, will that work? Will that be the catalyst to mend those relationships? I like to think so. But that's going to take a lot of decisions that are going to play themselves out over a period of time. But we never took the low road. I think that's important, too, because winning is just one part of it, right? We want to build a labor movement, and we don't want to unnecessarily make division where there isn't an advantage to have division. We've already won our elections. So we never took the low road and said these people aren't in solidarity. We've always tried publicly to speak in ways where we express our solidarity with the workers they represent, et cetera. And if they take the low road, you know, what are you going to do? anything you do, I mean, look, you don't want to make it too easy for management, but for the most part, the things you do in your union are going to get to management. There's going to be a rat too, you know, like at some point you're going to win based on your power and the power you build as a reflection of your strength. You're going to win, but it's going to get there and it can't be secret. Like it can't, and you can't worry about who's going to get promoted, who's not. And in a strange way, it might feel funny, but you want to see people come up through the ranks and get advanced to those more leadership positions in the mental health agency or wherever it may be, one would think. So it's kind of a good thing in a strange way. And you like to think that you're going to have some sympathetic people on the other side at some point, perhaps. But it's going to get to management. But here's a fun thing I like to do. If I know there's a rat, you know, I'm not saying somebody's going to get promoted, who's a good person, who's a steward. But if I know there's a rat, sometimes it's fun to talk a bunch of bullshit that's not true in front of that rat and try to figure out a way to bait them into telling that to management in a way that's to your advantage at the bargaining table. That's a little pleasure of mine. But anyway, I don't know that going to a union meeting is always the best thing to try to get someone to do who you want to be active in the union. Like, really, like, I know some locals where the last thing I'd want a brand new gung-ho union member to do would be go to this boring meeting. Maybe doing, like, a union happy hour at a pub, you know, like, to talk about some union, some things that have been going on with stewarding. That, to me, would be a lot more engaging and positive long-term than going through other business and meeting minutes and like that. But just a thought. Depends on the local. But as far as community engagement grows, basically, yeah. And so the thought is, how do you link up the labor movement with the community movements? I think that we're going to win in the end because of those alliances that are made. And we're not going to be able to be siloed, right, ultimately, because we have a lot more in common than we do not in common. So I could just, I don't have the answers, but I could tell you some of the things we've done in Vermont that seem to be working. We have created space at our conventions. It used to be the old conventions. You get 20 different politicians march up one after the other and come out and talk about whatever they're interested in and why they're great. And then everyone passively watches. And it's really, you just want to shoot yourself after a while, especially on day two when everyone's hungover. Because at that point, the only one that's going to a union convention is not to watch those politicians. It's to get good and drunk the night before, right? So we stopped doing that. No more politicians. We might have one. If we have one really good ally from the Progressive Party or what have you, maybe one. So we've taken that space and given it to community groups or non-union groups. A recent convention we had the local Justice for Palestine people speak. We had migrant justice, undocumented farm workers speak about their struggles. You know, we've gone Rights and Democracy, a group that's trying to expand community engagement on political issues. Vermont Worker Center, which largely these days deals with questions of expanding social benefits for people. So the Abenaki tribes, which are state-recognized Native American tribes. So we've created spaces for them to come talk about their struggles and where they could come and hear from our other speakers or other motions that we make, the debates we have, hear about our struggles. And in fact, when we had our historic convention on the general strike authorization vote, we encouraged community allies to come, not to vote. They don't get a vote, but to come and observe and even to speak if they have something relevant to offer. And then it can't just be that talking, right? I just walked on a migrant justice picket line on May Day. You got to show up and you got to be engaged when they need help in solidarity. And that's got to be a two-way street too, right? This isn't all charity work. We expect migrant justice to show up for us when we need them, and they do. You know, but developing the dialogue, creating spaces for groups to speak to each other, showing up to their things, them showing up to your things, you know, over time, I think that starts to create the notion of a popular front. Take those motherfuckers out. Look at what the teacher unions have done in Chicago, CTU, in LA, UTLA, I believe it is. They've done an incredible job. Or for that matter, the Wildcat strikes in West Virginia a few years ago. I think there is an appetite for radical change within the education unions. But it's the old guard that blocks it, values that fake relationship with management. And is it hard to fight them. Look, you are not anti-union by fighting against the union leadership. You are actually pro-union because you care enough to try to change it. And that is going to be uncomfortable. And will you target your neck? Maybe. But, you know, they organize trade unions in Colombia, you know, and people die to do that. Our ancestors died in this country to form unions in this country. So this stuff is hard. There's no anybody that comes to you and tells you there's some easier way to do it where you're protected are lying to you. They're blowing smoke up your ass because it is hard and it does make you a target. And that you could win or you could lose. But I can guarantee you, I can't tell you if you're going to win or not, but I can tell you if you don't come together and try, you're going to get the same half union that you always had, and we're not going to be able to transform society. I mean, I'm a believer. Don't let anything I said today tell you otherwise. I am a member of the AFL-CIO, a member of my local, and I always will be. There's no scenario where I'm not going to pay my dues. But I'm also not going to be content with a union or a labor movement that refuses to build and exercise its own power. And that's why we're sitting here talking, right? And people have figured this out. I mean, there's been revolutions in the world. You know, nothing is forever. And if we're going to make serious change in society, it's not going to be done without the active support of the working class. And with the working class, there's no other organization larger in the United States than the 12.5 million members of the AFL-CIO. So unless we're going to have a quixotic fantasy regarding some ideologically pure union that frankly has no relevance in our contemporary world, then we have to tackle these difficult questions of how we make change internally as we fight externally at the same time to defend what we have.